From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Like other recent Republican candidates, Senator John McCain will have to fight hard to even get a small percentage of the black vote. Last year, he skipped out on the NAACP convention. That was before he knew he would be the GOP's presidential nominee. Yesterday, he took the mic at the annual gathering and spoke out on education. For more, we're joined by Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Farai.
Ron, the NAACP has given McCain an F grade on his voting record in the past four Congresses. Last year, McCain didn't even bother to address the NAACP. So what makes things different this year for the McCain campaign?
Well, of course, he knows now that he is the nominee of the Republican Party. He doesn't have to worry about those elements of his own party that would like to see him refuse to address the NAACP. And he is now auditioning to be president. And that means looking presidential and speaking to all Americans.
So he focused on education and he called for sweeping reforms. Let's listen to a clip.
After decades of hearing the same big promises from the public education establishment and seeing the same poor results, it is surely time to shake off old ways and to demand new reforms.
So was this an unusual venue for McCain to focus on education, particularly on school vouchers, or was this a fertile field?
I think you could probably bring this subject up in front of just about any audience. And in this particular case, you might have a kind of common enemy. A lot of people in his audience have had their own struggles with the public education establishment, to use the phrase that McCain used. So this was a possible area of rapport, someplace he could find some common ground with his audience.
Senator McCain voted against making Martin Luther King Day a federal holiday, but he apologized in April for that decision. Is that kind of a change of heart enough to impress black voters?
It's a lot like the change of heart by which he came to the NAACP this year and did not last year. He's in a somewhat different posture at this point. But he has expressed regret in the past for having opposed the Martin Luther King holiday, and Arizona was one of the very last states to come around on the MLK holiday. That was the sentiment in his state at the time. He went along with it, and he has regretted that in the past.
He lavished a bit of praise on Obama at the top of his speech. Let's listen.
He's inspired a great many Americans, some of whom had wrongly believed that a political campaign could hold no purpose or meaning for them. His success should make Americans, all Americans, proud.
Now, oddly enough, his praise of Obama got the most enthusiastic response from the crowd during his own speech. Do you think that was a bit of a blow, or how should you interpret that?
No one wants to hear more applause when he mentions the name of his opponent than when he talks about himself, of course. But he knew this was going to be the case. I mean, the T-shirts, all the banners, all the buttons in the hall all say Obama. It's a little bit like being invited to address the national convention of the other party. So he knew he was in for that. But he also went out of his way a couple of points in the speech to say nice things about Barack Obama and to say at one point, now, I think it's great that he's come as far as he has. I hope he doesn't proved to be as successful as he liked to be, and he got a nice little laugh for that. But by and large, the reaction to the speech was one of polite applause. Someone described it as the kind of applause you hear at a golf tournament.
So a New York Times poll this week found only 2% of blacks are supporting McCain. Swaying the black vote might be a tall order, but how might his appearance before the NAACP benefit Senator McCain with other groups or in other ways?
I think it may very well benefit him with other groups. For one thing, it would look very bad for him to refuse a second year to attend this convention. I think President Bush suffered for the 5 years he didn't show up at this convention after 2000 when he did show up for it when he was running for president. But there is an aspect here, too, of a bank shot, if you will, that he is trying to appeal to those independent voters who, while they may not ever consider becoming members of the NAACP themselves and who may not really think about the concerns of African Americans very often, prefer a president who does not openly disrespect the aspirations of African Americans. They don't want to have a sense that a president is so partisan or so racially divisive that he would not be welcome at this convention. So when the invitation is extended, they would expect their president to accept it.
Well, Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you, Farai.
That was Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. He joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now for more on the future of the NAACP, we turn to Todd Shaw. He's an assistant professor of political science and African American studies at the University of South Carolina. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Farai.
So some folks say because a black man is making a serious bid for the White House, we are swiftly approaching a post-racial America. And you think about the NAACP. It was founded almost a century ago. That year, the year of founding, 69 black people were reportedly lynched. The NAACP worked on ending lynching, on economic and legal justice. So what's its mission today?
Well, Farai, I think the NAACP is doing a bit of rebranding in the sense that it's trying to figure out how to bridge this gap of the post-civil rights movement era. Julian Bond is almost 70 years of age now, and they have an interim executive or president, CEO. And I think they really do have to figure out how to push forward the economic agenda, the civil rights agenda at the same time. So its mission is continuing, but it's clear that it has to do some retooling for this new century.
So we've seen the two major party candidates come and speak, and they both said in their addresses that the work of the NAACP is far from over. Obama talked about personal responsibility. McCain talked about education. What do you think that each of them was looking to get from coming and speaking?
Well, I think from Obama's stance, he had to demonstrate that, yes, I am still African-American. I'm proud to be in the African-American community, but I can likewise speak to my constituencies on tough topics. I can both speak to the liberal aspiration of an activist and an interventionist government, and at the same time borrow somewhat from a more centrist or moderate message about personal responsibility. For John McCain, he has to throw off the shadow of George Bush and his own shadow, along with that of the party, of the Republicans not being seen as the big tent under which African Americans can gather. And so he has to demonstrate that the centrist moderate tendency also extends to race, and that he can also speak to African Americans and constituents not directly loyal to the Republican brand.
Let's go back a little bit to the NAACP itself. It just announced that the incoming president is Ben Jealous, who at 35 would be the youngest president of the NAACP ever. And he has said the NAACP has to market aggressively to people of all ages, but especially to men and women ages 23 to 50. Can he do it? How will he do it?
I think he can. I think that the NAACP, at least for a number of years, has been trying in its search to bridge this gap. And I think Jealous, being of that generation, you know, I don't want to quite call it the Obama generation quite yet, but being of that younger sort of post-civil rights generation, may be able to hit that bridge. And I've observed over the number of years that the organization has tried to bring in more youthful faces through its youth conferences, tried to sort of demonstrate this sense of current relevance. I do think that in order to get past with its legacy, it really does have to have a new face, set of faces. And that's a difficult issue, because how do you ask those who were veterans to simply step aside? But I do think the challenge is there, and they're moving in that direction, but they know the difficulties they still face.
Well, what you're saying about leadership leads us to another issue. This weekend, we talked to the NAACP spokesperson, who mentioned that the incoming president, Jealous, had not signed his contract yet. So when we spoke to the NAACP's powerful board chair, Julian Bond, on air, I asked if he was prepared for the organization to have a strong president. Here's how he responded.
I'm looking forward to Ben Jealous. I think he's going to be among the strongest we've ever had, and may turn out to be the strongest we've ever had.
Do you think the fact that the incoming president, scheduled to come in September, has not signed his contract yet and apparently has not been voted on by the executive committee yet, is that a sign that there could be a renegotiation before the start date?
Well, Farah, I don't have any information on hand if there's a bit of negotiation going on. But I would suspect that if there was this negotiation, the issues that we've brought up are precisely those that are on the table. Exactly how much authority would the president have? How free a hand? There's been, you know, that ongoing criticism about the size of the NAACP board, and who can sort of step into these key positions. So I suspect if there is some wrangling a bit, then those are key considerations, because that's what moves an organization and changes the face of an organization.
What role do you see this organization playing during this election?
Oh, I'm sure to be as active as it has been in the past. I think the NAACP is sort of that organization that is sort of the civic forum of a key civic forum for Black America. It remains that in many regards, even though the various generations are looking to various other groups and various other influences for their political views. I think particularly with regards to policy relevance and ongoing civil rights concerns, that the NAACP is an important voice. And it still is one of the very few organizations that has as long a legacy as it does, and it extends in areas of Black America as much as it does, even given the struggle it has about how to be relevant, even given America and Black America are changing.
Todd, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Todd Shaw is an assistant professor of political science and African American studies at the University of South Carolina. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. This month we're talking about jazz, who plays it, where it came from, and how it was born. Today we want to find out where you can hear it. Are there any jazz meccas left in the country? And how have live venues helped shape and create some of our greatest jazz artists? With us now, Ron Sturm. He's the owner of Iridium Jazz Club in New York City. Also, saxophonist Dennis Winslet. He's an education specialist at the American Jazz Museum in Kansas City. And Peter Williams. He's the artistic director of Yoshi's Jazz Club in Oakland and now San Francisco as well. Welcome, everyone.
Hi.
Hi. Nice to be here. Good to be here.
So, Dennis, let me start with you. When people think of jazz, they think of New Orleans, but what other cities have been jazz meccas throughout the years?
I think as you see the progression of jazz throughout American culture, each city has built its own brand. And even today, when you go to New York, you know, there's different schools. There's people like, you know, I'm from Chicago, or I'm from St. Louis. You know, there's these different brotherhoods, and each has their own unique sound, and we're developed regionally. And I think New York has just become a melting pot of all these different regions coming together in one place.
Dennis, you're a Kansas City native. What's the culture that you grew up in as a musician?
Well, I was one of the last generation to come up under the tutelage of the Mutual Musicians Foundation, which is one of the venues that's been here since 1930 and was the home of the 627 Negroes Musician Union. And so I got to hang out with some of those musicians, the elder statesmen, so to speak. There was a rich history, a rich heritage that I was able to come up in and take part of. And that is very much undercurrent today, but it's still very much alive here in Kansas City.
Well, before we go on, tell me about this union, the 627. What was it about? Who was it started by?
Well, the 627, during the heyday of Kansas City, you know, we say jazz was born in New Orleans, but it grew up here in Kansas City. The unions were separate. The 18th and Vine District, which was the entertainment district here in Kansas City, had everything over 125 clubs that reigned. And of course, Tom Pendergast, who was the mayor of Kansas City, or Boss Pendergast, as he was known, pretty much opened the city up. And during Prohibition, people don't know, there wasn't one felony conviction of alcohol possession in the city of Kansas City. And so musicians flocked to Kansas City because they can make a very good living. And you had to be a member, if you were a Black musician, of the 627 to work. And they would go around and make sure that the musicians got paid, because it wasn't like if you didn't get paid, you could go downtown and file a lawsuit. And so they brokered with, you know, the club owners and the powers that be to make sure the musicians got paid. And that's one of the ways that we would keep track of some of the great musicians, such as Charlie Parker. First thing they did when they came to town, they went to the union hall and they paid their union dues and got their card so they could perform.
Ron, from your point of view, what do you think is... what cities and you know are the still the heart of jazz today?
That's a really good question. from my vantage point, New York has to be one of the most diverse and interesting meccas for jazz, just because of the sheer volume and depth and breadth of what we offer here. I only really know it from the jazz club perspective of, like, where there are hotbeds of, like, important jazz clubs, not as a musician. So I'm coming from it as a different perspective. Like, you know, Yoshi's in California is very well respected, and Iridium here, and Blue Note, and Birdland, and Vanguard, and we have a big pocket here. New York is pretty important because we just can support so many jazz clubs and live music offerings. That's why I think New York is, it's just amazing how much music we have here, jazz music.
I'm going to go back to New York in a second and have you talk about that. But
yeah.
I want to dip into Yoshi's because there's what role does it play for a West Coast audience? People from the East Coast may not know much about it.
Well, we bring I'd have to agree with Ron there, too. New York is definitely the jazz capital of the world. So many of the musicians that I bring to Yoshi's come from New York. They just everybody lives there. So we've got a pretty good scene out here on the West Coast, but we've got a long way to go to catch up to New York.
It's just it's a function of the audience that is out there to hear, you know, the live music, you know, where it's going to be the biggest pockets.
New York is such a media mecca, and that's where, you know, the musicians go.
That's true. That's
you know, to meet up and to put bands together with musicians at the highest level.
It's also so easy to get to Europe from New York. I think that's what I hear from a lot of the musicians that come out here as well.
Ron, let's talk about the Vanguard, the Village Vanguard, the most notable, arguably, jazz club still standing. Mm-hmm. As a jazz club owner, what has the Vanguard, from your perspective, done for jazz?
It's just such an institution. It's been, I think, playing live music since the 30s. Is that correct? I think the 30s. It's just a very important home for jazz because, from a business perspective, they can do a lot of they can break a lot of acts and do a lot of artists that a lot of us can't necessarily do because they're the Vanguard. Like Iridium has done, and Yoshi's and Vanguard, and we all have our special brand and our name, and people are going to come hear the music at a certain club, and the Vanguard is kind of like, it's a Vanguard. You know, the name is synonymous.
Anytime I talk to people here in California who are going to New York, that's always on their list of clubs they want to see.
It doesn't matter who's playing there.
Exactly. It's the most famous jazz club. There are probably more live recordings made at the Vanguard than all other clubs combined, I would think.
Not a huge club either.
No, it's a small room, but the sound is good, and it's got a vibe, and it's got a scene, and people love to go there.
Yeah,
it's a great historical spot.
Yeah, it's its own little spot. It's special.
Dennis, let's turn to performances. When you think of historical live performances, does any one artist come to mind?
Probably Charlie Parker at Massey Hall, where he comes out with this little Grafton plastic saxophone and and plays an incredible concert with some of the, you know, the icons of jazz, Dizzy Gillespie and Max Roach, and I think Charles Mingus was on that date. And I think that's one of the beauties when you talk about, you know, the Vanguard. You think about all the live recordings and part of the club experience is coming and seeing the musicians react to what's going on at the club that night. You know, when Charlie Parker was notorious for, you know, picking up something that was happening in the club and interjecting it into a tune. I think that's part of the essence of places like the Vanguard and Birdland. You think about historic clubs.
Well, we want to play a little bit of Charlie Parker. This is a tune called Blue and Boogie.
And those are the gentlemen that are here up until this coming Wednesday, and we'd love for you to come by and dig Dizzy and Bird and Bud Powell. As I said before, three of the greatest gentlemen of modern music. What do we do first? You say you will. That was made with Dexter, wasn't it, years ago? Here it is, Blue and Boogie.
So you can tell that there was a joie de vivre there. There was this, you know, camaraderie. You know, Peter, when you hear that, what did you hear?
Well, you just heard, you could sort of tell that there was some joking around with the musicians going on stage when the announcer was talking, and they just wanted to start blowing. They didn't even want to let him finish what he had to say. They just jumped in while he was going. And, you know, there's just such a spark and an energy to this particular track and to jazz in general. That's why I'm here. That's why I love it. And I was thinking just a minute ago, one of the things that I love about jazz, and I'm sure that Dennis and Ron both agree, if you see a band two nights in a row and they play the same song, it's going to be different. Whereas other styles of music, you know, it's the jazz musicians are reacting to the audience and what's going on, and it can be a slow tune one night and pick it up the next, and there's so much freedom and so much energy to the music and picking up on what's going on around them. That's one of my favorite things about it.
We're talking with Peter Williams. He's the artistic director of Yoshi's Jazz Club in Oakland and also now another branch in San Francisco. We also have Dennis Winslet. He's an education specialist at the American Jazz Museum in Kansas City. And Ron Sturm, the owner of Iridium Jazz Club in New York City. This is NPR's News and Notes, in case you're just tuning in midway. So I want to go, Peter, and play a little bit of what was recorded live at Yoshi's. Here's a little bit of pianist Mulgrew Miller's live recording at your club. Were you there for that recording?
I was. It was a great night. Mulgrew and the trio were in just great moods. They were excited about doing the recording. They'd been on a little mini tour and had just come up from Los Angeles. So the band was really geared up for this recording, and it's documented on two different CDs, Live at Yoshi's Volumes 1 and 2 from Max Jazz. And just to me, it's just epitomizes what jazz is all about. They play standards, they do some original tunes, the band stretches out, and Mulgrew Miller is just such a brilliant player.
Ron, when you think about some of the different moments you've had in your life as a fan, is there anything that stands out just from a fan perspective entirely?
Well, the coolest thing that I've seen was when at the club there was a jam session, and Wynton Marsalis was playing with Lionel Hampton. And Lionel Hampton
wow.
was, yeah, that was really cool. And Lionel Hampton was, you know, very old, but there was still a fire in his eyes. It was towards the end of his life, and he was playing piano just with, like, one finger or something. But, you know, there was so much transmitted in that one finger that it was amazing. It's just, you know, the older the jazz musicians get, it seems like the more, I mean, I don't want to make a generalization, but you really need to live to play jazz, I think. And when you get to that level, it's like there's something that pervades the music that's unbelievable and you can't quantify it.
Dennis, we've talked on this series about how do you do outreach to people who may not be familiar with jazz. And again, you're an education specialist at the American Jazz Museum in Kansas City. So what do you do? How do you reach out to people who may not be the typical audience, who may not have a long body of stories about when I was at Birdland, I saw so-and-so?
Yeah, and, you know, my experience, you know, spend quite a bit of time in Chicago is really falling in love with the grassroots clubs, places like, you know, Fred Anderson's Velvet Lounge on the South Side, you know, the smaller clubs that will take a risk of bringing in artists. You know, when I was up and coming that didn't have a big name, you know, my music wasn't mainstream, but to just say, hey, come and play and build an audience. And that's one of the things that we have the luxury of doing, you know, at the American Jazz Museum with our Blue Room nightclub, which has really become one of the, you know, the clubs in the Midwest that can bring in artists that normally wouldn't come in because we're a nonprofit. We're not necessarily tied to, you know, having to deal with overhead, which is, you know, a big thing for lots of jazz clubs today, and to present music for art's sake, not because it's going to, we know that we're going to be able to draw a profit from it. But that's one of the things that I enjoy as a musician and as an educator, is being able to bring in something that you may not have heard before, because it just monetarily wasn't viable for, you know, the mainstream clubs to bring these acts in.
Ron, do you like going to the underground clubs still? I mean, yours is a major venue, but are there any holes in the wall that you like to visit?
Yeah, there are a couple of clubs in New York that are interesting. I just wanted to make a point that it's true that there needs to be a hotbed of smaller clubs and nonprofit organizations to bring the music out. It's really important because there is it's not viable all the time to break acts that you'd want to break.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of the Mingus Big Band, which performs every Tuesday night at Iridium. Here's some of their live performance. How would you describe your crowd? Who shows up to see this music?
Mingus has its own audience, and we have Les Paul on Monday, and that has its own audience. It's diverse. It's about 50% tourists, 50% locals. But it depends on the night. It depends on who's playing.
What about age?
Age, thankfully, we're starting to see some younger people come into the music, which is nice. College age to, like, 50s or 60s, I would say, but I think our target is about 40-odd.
And Peter, at Yoshi's, you've got one in Oakland and one in San Francisco, which are geographically pretty close, but as people who have lived or been to the Bay know, there's kind of these micro-neighborhoods, so they're not really the same. But what about the age or the type of people who come into your clubs?
Well, Like Ron said, it really kind of varies from act to act. We like to say at Yoshi's that we get everybody in from 8 to 80. One of the things that we do is we've done it for a few years. We stopped it and we're just starting up again is a Sunday matinee for kids. So they go during the day. They start at 2 in the afternoon. We have a very, very discounted ticket for the kids because that's what we have to do. We've got to get kids in to see this music and hear it and learn about it. And you know, maybe they'll be bringing their kids to the matinees down the line. But we really do. We'll see, high school, college kids, and we'll see seniors. And it's just really dependent on who the act is and what's in the club.
All right. Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for sharing your time with us.
Well, thank you very much for doing this.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's very important. And there's something about seeing live music that really beats anything. And we can encourage people to obviously go out and hear it.
All right. Well, Dennis, we're going to go out playing a bit of your music, Soul Journey. We were speaking with Dennis Winslet. He's a saxophonist and an education specialist at the American Jazz Museum in Kansas City, Missouri. He spoke with us from the studios at member station KCUR. Ron Sturm is the owner of New York's Iridium Jazz Club. He joined us from our NPR studios in New York. And Peter Williams is the artistic director of Yoshi's Jazz Clubs in Oakland and San Francisco. He was at KQED in San Francisco. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Thursday is our day to look at the world of sports, and here to handle things is our man, Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. You know, in sports, you can take the player out of the streets, but oftentimes it's not as easy to take the street out of the player, and that has created all sorts of problems for big-time sports, both pro and college. So we asked a couple of bloggers, both in their early 20s, to help us sort it out, one from the East Coast, one from the West. Kevin Figures blogs for Sports Talk Radio, AM570radio.com. That's here in L.A. And out of Atlanta is Karin Phillips. He blogs for TheMavenReport.com. Welcome, guys.
How you doing, Tony?
Welcome.
Great. So let me set it up for you this way. Yesterday, we spoke with New York Giants receiver David Tyree, who made that spectacular catch in the Super Bowl this year. He talked very candidly about his troubled past with drugs and alcohol and misbehaving. Tyree was once fined by his team a few years ago, and he decided to pay the fine by breaking the law and selling drugs to raise the money. Listen to this.
when I got the fines, you know, basically my mindset was, hey, man, I got some good bud, I got some good marijuana, I might as well start selling it. And, you know, it's just it's amazing how gripped you can become, you know, and people like to think that, you know, the music or, you know, the things that are, you know, out there in our society don't have impact on people, but they do. You know, everybody, my thing was, hey, it was a keep it real generation. And that's as real as it gets. You know, you want to be a gangster, let's stop playing.
So Tyree has since, of course, had an epiphany, turned his life around, and is now sharing his story to help others. Interestingly, though, Kevin, it comes just as the NFL announced this week that it's cracking down on the gangster culture among its players. The league is going to start checking for evidence of gang signs. That's right, gang signs being thrown up during football games by the players. How rampant is this gangster culture?
It's pretty rampant. And people always, when they associate this with sports, they normally associate it with the NBA. They always talk about the tattoos and the entourages with hip-hop and whatnot. And this is a new thing for me as far as the NFL. I've never really noticed it all that much. And it's interesting, there was a quote by Dennis Northcutt, Jacksonville Jaguar receiver, who says a lot of times there are a lot of different signs that are used on sidelines during for different personnel groupings that may look like a gang sign. And it'll be hard for people to differentiate from that kind of thing. So I think it'll be pretty tough for the NFL to say, well, this is a gang sign or this isn't. How do you know that you're throwing up a gang sign from some street corner or if you're trying to say, hey, it's time to go big on the goal line?
This is really fascinating, Karen. What's your take on it? Have you observed this or have you talked about this with anybody?
I've seen it in other sports, but not so much in the NFL. Like Kevin was saying, I agree with him. It's going to be hard to kind of differentiate between the signs. But my thing is, even if it is going on, if it is a problem, which Roger Goodell is looking to crack down on, I think finding the actual person who's going to be able to, you know, be able to get in the culture of the players and understand and hear their side of the story, even if it is happening. And if this is going on, mentor some of these younger players and in terms of them letting go of their street culture, you know, like you said, of letting go of that gangster lifestyle.
Well, you know, you both bring up an interesting point, and the fact that you both are in your 20s is and closer to this than someone in my age group would be. I see it, and I don't know what I'm seeing. It's hard enough just trying to figure out the graffiti on the walls half the time. The league has apparently hired experts to review game tapes, as we said, to see which players are flashing these signs. You think, Kevin, that this is maybe a little overboard for a league that probably doesn't really know what it's going to be getting itself into?
Absolutely. I think it's totally overblown. I think they're sort of overreacting to, I think it was referenced, the Paul Pierce situation in the playoffs against the Hawks where he threw up what was clearly what I saw as a gang sign. He tried to say that it wasn't, but anyone in the Southern California area who knows anything about that knows that was clearly a gang sign.
Well, let me stop you right there because okay. I know that Paul Pierce is from Inglewood, which
yes.
is just a stone's throw from where we're sitting right now here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I know that you are from Inglewood also. Right. So
yes, exactly.
That was a sign that
Absolutely.
He threw up.
Absolutely.
He denied it, but who could prove otherwise?
Only people that know. Yeah. People that know can prove it. People generally reporting on the subject of it really don't know, and they'll take what Paul tells them or what Danny Ainge tells them and say, like, it's the truth. That's just, it means blood, sweat, and tears or whatever he tried to say that it meant.
Now, you know, Kevin is here in California, as I said, where the gang problem is endemic. And we know that it's not just in California, but down there in Atlanta with you, Karen, is there a connection between the gang thug life and signs and that sort of behavior and activity on either the football field or the basketball court?
Yes, more than likely currently is, but think looking at the NFL situation with Roger Goodell, agreeing with Kevin, I believe it is overblown. I think it's just another step in Roger Goodell becoming a tyrant, just like David Stern is doing in the NBA. But I understand his thinking and logic on the situation because it is his, you know, it is his league. But it's just another testament of what the NFL now stands for, the No Fun League.
The No Fun League. Let me follow up with one thing with you, Karen, then we're going to move on to another topic. It's this. You graduated from Morehouse College, which is a prestigious HBCU for black males. How do you go about countering this gangster culture? Can it be done? Do they teach it down there?
And it all, at the end of the day, it's all about the individual. Because, you know, looking at athletes now, and if they came from, you know, a rough neighborhood or they came from the hood or whatnot. And sometimes, you know, only the hood was there for you. But at that, when you get to a certain level, like a Paul Pierce, you have to, as a man, look at yourself and say, hey, for me to go to this next step, I have to let go of the hood.
Mm-hmm. Some guys
and
have
if,
a
and
hard
if that
time
hood
like
is
that.
Really your hood, the hood should understand that they have to let go of you as well.
All right, let's move on to another topic. You know, baseball was all over the news this week because of the All-Star game, and the mm-hmm. player that stole the show was Texas Ranger Josh Hamilton. He hit an amazing 28 home runs in the first round of the Home Run Derby event, 13 in a row, I believe, which had the Yankee Stadium crowd chanting his name. Now, just 2 weeks before, though, when Josh Hamilton was back at Yankee Stadium with his team, the chant was, quote, Josh smokes crack, end quote. That's because all the fans knew that Hamilton had been banned from baseball due to his addiction to crack cocaine. Now reinstated, he is having a fantastic year. What do you make, Kevin, of Josh Hamilton's story, and how are some athletes celebrated for overcoming addictions and legal troubles while others are not?
It's a tough question. I think the Josh Hamilton story is a great story. It's a guy who, like you said, is a, I don't want to say rags to riches, but from he was down in the dumps, he couldn't go any lower. To being he was the number one pick, he had a lot of potential, and then just basically threw it all away to come up now to be one of the best players in baseball and to steal the show. Why other players aren't embraced? It could be a number of reasons. There could be their attitude, the way they act towards the media. A lot of media members are really, you know, fickle about a lot of things. If an athlete tells them off or doesn't say anything to them, they'll hold that against them for the rest of their career. Josh Hamilton seems like a humble guy who's really apologetic, who's really turned his life around and wants to help other people through that. And some athletes aren't willing to do that. Some athletes are just kind of standoffish and aren't willing to talk about things like that. So a lot of people in the media aren't willing to forgive them that quickly.
Well, Kyron, how much is race a factor, do you think? Is race a factor at all, Josh Hamilton being white in this particular case?
I think it's a huge factor. I mean, Hamilton is saying all the right things at the right times, but, you know, let's get down to the basics. He's white. And that's the truth about it, because when we look at other players, say like a Michael Irvin who had drug problems, but Michael Irvin was never banned from the NFL. And people are forgetting, yes, Josh Hamilton was banned from baseball, but he also went to rehab 8 times. And the story is great. It's uplifting. It's powerful. It should be on one of those behind the glory stories that come on, a sob story. You know, he triumphed. He came through. I'm happy for the guy. But at the end of the day, if Josh Hamilton's name was Jeremy Jenkins,
you think it'd be a different
the media
story?
wouldn't be covering it like this.
All right, let's move on to another topic. You know that I'm also a college professor, and so I took particular notice when a new way to skip class was invented this week by one of the best high school basketball players in the country. Brandon Jeez. Jennings is a highly touted point guard from Oak Hill Academy in Virginia, by way of Compton, California, by the way, decided to skip going to the University of Arizona and a scholarship and jumped directly to the professional ranks in Europe this week, signing a multi-million-dollar 3-year deal to play in Italy. He is the first young American athlete in this country to do that in basketball. Kevin, what are the implications for the NBA and for the NCAA?
Well, the implications that this is going to start a trend. I mean, there's going to be more players that are going to be willing to go overseas to see that, because there's never been a pioneer to do it yet. Brandon Jennings will be the first one to actually cross the board. It's been talked about the last couple of years since the rule was instituted, but now Brandon Jennings is the first one to actually do it. And I mean, even though he signed a 3-year deal, there are always out clauses. The team could draft him, and they can pay the team overseas off to get the player over here even quicker. So I think it's going to start a trend. You're going to start seeing a lot more great high school basketball players going overseas.
Well, Kyron, it looks as if the NBA's attempt to try to manipulate who comes into the league and at what age is backfiring, doesn't it?
Yes, I love Brandon Jennings. He is David Stern's worst nightmare. And because of this, he had to be the pioneer. His name was big enough to actually do this. And now I'm looking at other high school stars coming up, possibly like a Lance Stevenson. He hasn't committed yet. He's giving them another way, because this was actually the first year someone was drafted from the NBDL. So that's showing the world and these other high school players that route isn't working. And instead of me going to college and playing for 1 year and doing what David Stern says and getting, let's be honest, paid under the table, I can go overseas, get paid a couple million, and come right back.
Now, I'm not sure about the paid under the table comment. We don't have time to explore that further. I don't want to let it go without recognizing that that's something we should deal with in a future conversation. But back to this, in terms of the universities, Kevin Figures, if you're Lute Olson, let's say, the coach of University of Arizona who lost this kid and who may lose others, what do you do to counter this?
I don't know if there's anything you can do. Lute actually had a good quote last week where he said, "I'm never going to recruit another one-and-done player again." Now, whether he's just saying that, I'm not sure. I'm sure if there's a great recruit that has interest in the University of Arizona, he's going to try to get him. But basically, Lute is like, you know, I'm tired of this. I went through this with Jared Bayless last year, who told me if he had a good year, he may want to think about coming back. Jared's gone, and that screwed up their chances of maybe being a Final Four team next year. But if there's Lute, I don't know if there's much that you really can do. You can just do what you have been, try to see if you can get a kid to stick and see what you can. But, I mean, Lute says he's done with one-and-done players.
Did you believe Lute, Karin?
At first I did. Then I thought about it, and I thought it was an emotional comment, being that he missed all of last season. He missed Jared Bayless. And after Alex Jennings decommitted from USC to come to Arizona, everyone thought he would stick around for at least 1 year. But seeing that he skipped overseas, I think the comment is, you know, a little emotional comment, because Arizona is known for being, you know, point guard university.
That's true.
Having all the great point guards they've had in the past, and Lute has missed out on maybe two of the greatest. And the only thing now he has left is Chase Buttinger. And let's be honest, you know, Arizona hasn't been a powerhouse in the last couple of years.
All right, let me stop you there, because I've got 10 seconds for something. I don't want either of you to go away without answering this really quickly. Brett Favre,
okay. Mm-hmm.
Green Bay Packers. Is he going to play in the NFL next season?
Yes.
Kevin?
Yes, not for Green Bay, though.
Karin, is he going to play?
Yes, somewhere.
Somewhere, but not for Green Bay for sure, and not for Minnesota probably.
No.
Guys, it's wonderful to have both of you on. We'll do it again.
Yes, Tony, thank you.
Thank you.
That was NPR's Tony Cox speaking with Kevin Figures, a blogger for Sports Talk Radio, AM570radio.com here in Los Angeles. He joined us here at our NPR West studios. And Karin Phillips, he blogs for The Maven Report. He joined us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How are you?
I am doing great. So what are folks saying this week?
Well, this week we've been getting a lot of comments on our blog about the fallout from the New Yorker magazine cover showing a turban-wearing Barack Obama fist-jabbing an AK-47 toting Michelle Obama. We got some letters about the story, too. Fahim Rasool wrote in to say the way you handled the story on Monday's Bloggers Roundtable was right on.
He wrote, "People, what is wrong with being Muslim in America? The media seem to be running a smear campaign to discredit the religion and make it seem like a cult or some terrorist organization. Every time that a suicide bomber or Osama bin Laden does something, the media call it Islamic terrorist. But when Timothy McVeigh bombed the federal building that killed hundreds of innocent people, was he called a Christian terrorist? The bottom line is that they are just terrorists. As for Obama, the Christian, it is just racist America taking a stab at your character as a black American. Keep your eye on the prize."
Brian Winkleman in Philadelphia thinks the way we covered a mostly black neighborhood in Ohio that didn't have access to public tap water was depressing. He wrote us this: "Here was a perfect example of a community of black Americans who, when subjected to a difficult situation, demonstrated awesome self-reliance, initiative, and brilliance in overcoming it. Sadly, your program focused on complaining about racist white people. Maybe there'd be less racists if black leaders stopped whining about all of their problems."
Ron Ward wrote in about last Wednesday's Bloggers Roundtable, about a campaign encouraging advertisers to boycott some of BET's programming. "I am wondering if TV boycotts work. It frustrates me that we can be on the verge of electing a man of color for highest office of the land, but I can't get any people of color in front or behind the camera."
And Devin Stokesbury in Cincinnati, Ohio, commented on our month-long series on jazz, where we've covered the trend of broadcast radio stations dropping jazz programming from their lineups. "Jazz was removed from my local NPR stations about 5 years ago. Since then, I've turned to XM, Pandora.com, and internet stations to listen to jazz. Pandora has been especially helpful, helping me to hear a depth of jazz variety that I never knew existed. I think these outlets will give jazz its second wind."
And finally, Diapriya Kukuzeemans in New Delhi, India, wrote in about singer Renee Marie, who sang this instead of the Star Spangled Banner at Denver's State of the City address.
Lift every voice and sing.
He wrote, "I'm loving Renee, and why not? It gives due respect to the fact that we are a multicultural society, not just a white society with a bunch of others. Go, girl. That was brave and uniquely American and creative."
And that's it for letters. Thank you for writing, and please keep your comments coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.